Hey there. To celebrate the premiere of this season of Real Lich Hours, we're running a promotion. You're hearing this. Everybody's hearing this. The episode's available publicly. If you would like to get the rest of the season and all of our other Patreon premium content, you can use the coupon code EMBRACE to get 20% off of your first month. That is the code EMBRACE when you go and sign up at patreon.com/duckfeedtv. Thanks.
My name is Gary Butterfield.
My name is Kay Ross.
And you're listening to Real Lich Hours, the Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines podcast with art by Randy Walker and music by Gwen Static.
And we're here. It's a new season. I've got a new name. That happened in the meantime. Hi, I'm trans. New name. Everything's the same.
Bleh.
That's right. Speaking of times of transformation, we're becoming vampires.
Bleh.
But yeah, no, I'm not saying bleh because it's like underwhelming or I'm exhausted. I'm saying bleh for vampire reasons.
It's the vampire Pokemon noise, you know,
they just Dracula, go bleh. Dracula.
Yeah, we're into season two now, Real Lich Hours, and we're covering Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines. One of the coolest, I would say, computer role-playing games. Everyone who has played it talks about it. And stuff. It's in the when you hear the name, if you're in the know, you install it. Kind of Deus Ex pile. But it is locked on, you know, old janky hardware, and not a lot of people have played it.
Yeah.
So we are going to shed some light on this and kill these vampires with sunlight.
We are. Yeah, I'm excited. I have not played this since we covered it on WAF 14 years ago.
14 years ago. Yeah. This was something we did on our flagship show, Watch Out for Fireballs. It was our fifth episode before we had our format really figured out.
Yes.
Here. If you're not familiar with the kind of basics of this game, it is a little bit hard to quantify. It has some MSIM DMA. Some of it is like a Obsidian reactivity game, like choices matter down to really small details. It's real janky. Exceedingly janky.
Yeah.
It's a lot of different things to it.
Yeah.
And the story of how we, or go ahead.
Oh no. And I mean, and the reason it fits on the show is, you know, like it's a video game adaptation of a tabletop game, right?
Yeah. It doesn't necessarily mean that will always be what the show is, but we're still figuring it out.
Yeah.
You know, you need 2 points to make a line.
Yes.
The kind of the story of what brought us here, a patron named Jeremy, so big shout out to Jeremy, sponsored a Bloodlines episode of Watch Out for Fireballs. We have been talking about revisiting it for a long time because I, you know, for it's one of my favorite games. And I don't like that we covered it that early in the run.
Yeah.
Just because I feel like we would have done a better job. Now, one of the things is back in the day, we were like, you got to be got to get in and out in about an hour, hour and a half. Anything more than that is too much.
Yeah.
And I distinctly remember rushing, kind of doing what the developers did and rushing the last third of the game. So Jeremy went and sponsored that. And we had this whole idea like, oh, we had this on the schedule. And then we didn't have anything for season two and thought, huh, what if we went real close up on it?
Yeah. Like
ran that by Jeremy and everything's good.
Yeah. So talking about a beloved game and here's a whole new like setting, and you know, world to talk about as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to have some differences. And I think this is probably going to be true every season of this show.
Yeah.
Especially, because the tabletop systems, if we keep doing that, are going to be very different. And then the games themselves and how they relate to them are different. So I kind of wrote out some ways to prime everybody. This is an episode zero. We're not really getting into it. We're telling you what to expect this season.
Yes.
And these are some ways it's going to be different than Real Witch Hours season one.
Yeah.
In pretty big ways, I think.
Mm-hmm. So what's the first way here?
This is based on a tabletop system, the White Wolf Vampire the Masquerade tabletop role-playing system, part of the larger world of Old World of Darkness. And one of the biggest things is I know D&D a lot better than I know Old World of Darkness.
Yeah.
I've only played a little bit of Vampire. Most of my exposure is from wikis, reading through source books, this game, things like that. So I'm not going to have like tons of anecdotes about the old days. I'm not going to be as reliable as a source about the tabletop part. Mm-hmm. Not that I was like perfect about, you know, fifth edition D&D, but I had more experience with D&D.
Yeah.
This I don't have. And Vampire, like all tabletop systems, has tensions between different editions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's Old World of Darkness and New World of Darkness. we are not going to be accurate to any tabletop experience you are likely to have.
Yes.
If we call out a clan or something like that, there is a good chance that within the meta story of Vampire the Masquerade, that clan has been dissolved.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, this is actually a thing that's going to come up when we eventually cover Torment as well.
Yeah.
Torment had the faction war and, or Planescape had the faction war, and Torment takes place before that. And that was a big shakeup.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're kind of frozen in amber here.
Yeah. I don't have a lot of experience. I've never played at the table, with Vampire the Masquerade. Like Bloodlines was pretty much my first exposure to it. Other than like maybe, I don't know, flipping through some of the books at Walden Books back in the day in the tabletop section, shelf. It wasn't that big back then. But yeah, it's all been Bloodlines and then just like flipping through PDFs of source books, reading the fifth edition book when that came out, like that.
It is, if you're a TV Tropes American, it is one of the most fun.
Yeah.
One of those to go down.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, this game is, you know, you said that Bloodlines was your only exposure to Vampire. I think that's true for most people.
Mm-hmm.
And Bloodlines is not a widely played game in the world of games.
Right.
Like, this is known, but we just covered Baldur's Gate 3, which was a sensation.
Yeah.
Because this is not, one of the ways this season will be different is this game is not as well documented.
Mm-hmm.
So there aren't as many resources.
Yeah.
You know, there are wikis, there are walkthroughs, stuff like that. But I don't have, you know, Gary Barfield does not have time to do data mining and extensive testing on Bloodlines.
Mm-hmm.
Real Lich Hour is just part of the network. There's a hole for that. Somebody should do it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a need. I would appreciate it if they did it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to be relying on kind of what I have. There are things that are not explained, especially in terms of like the numbers behind things.
Yeah.
This game has not been thoroughly documented in terms of that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, in addition to like a lot of the tabletop stuff is kind of obscured, you know, like it is not showing you the math in the way that a Baldur's Gate 3 does, right?
Yes.
Where you can kind of see not just the roles, but like it gives you the formula for how most of this is going to apply just right there in the interface.
Yes. This is a way less transparent game.
Yeah.
Than that.
Mm-hmm.
Next, this game is a huge mess. So it's a technical mess. And we're running it with a mod to see more content.
Yeah.
And this can give us kind of more digressionary path. So there are going to be glitches and goofs, things like that. Our experience playing this might not match yours. No experience of Bloodlines is basically the same because this is a game that nobody plays out of the box.
Right.
It's in the Morrowind Oblivion pile with that.
Yeah. Gotta shine it up with some mods, is what you have to do. Possibly even to get it to run. This is one of those weird games on Steam where you can buy it. There's no guarantee that you're going to be able to play it.
Yeah. Like you will eventually.
Yeah.
You can play, you know, play along with us, like get it to work, but it might take a little bit of time. It is the charms of PC gaming.
Mm-hmm.
So the mod, that we're playing is called the Clan Quest mod. It comes with a version of the unofficial patch. The unofficial patch is kind of the minimum. If you're listening to this and you're going to play along with us, go ahead and do the Clan Quest mod. Just Google it. It's the one that pops up on Nexus Mod. It comes with the unofficial. If you're not interested in that extra content, if you want to play something closer to the vanilla, at the very least, do the unofficial mod.
Yeah.
That will make it work. there and restores some cut content that was cut for no real good reason.
Yeah.
After that.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth, I guess, there are a lot of little points here. Mm-hmm. It's a really different game.
Yeah.
Both the video game and the tabletop game. So there's not like a really strong bestiary. You know, there's only a handful of spells. It's not a tactical game.
No.
You know, it's based in the United States. It'd be weird for us to do, you know, a little segment on Santa Monica and the history of Santa Monica.
The far off, you know, land of Omaha.
Yeah, let's figure out what Omaha's like in here. So there's gonna be a little bit less variety to the segments.
Mm-hmm.
To this, there'll still be segments and stuff. I'm like four notes in deep, mm-hmm, into this because I wanted to get out ahead of it. But we are going to be drawing on some stuff from outside of the game for those segments.
Yeah,
from just kind of the grander world of darkness, because we're never going to be able to talk about some of this cool shit.
Right.
Otherwise, mm-hmm, there's a Frankenstein's game.
Yep. Promethean.
In World of Darkness. Yeah. Promethean the Created, where you, mm-hmm, roll up a crew of Frankensteins who hang out together. And it's not, you know, it's golems, it's automata, it's like, you know, just constructs.
Yeah.
But basically, Frankensteins. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff is so fun.
Yep.
And cool. We will never get a chance to talk about that on this network.
Right.
You know, until they make a Promethean the Created game.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to talk about these like clan close-ups, but we're also going to talk about the greater world of darkness.
Yeah.
Some of that comes up in the game. Some of it does not.
Yeah. And God, there's so much cool stuff in Wraith. There's so much cool stuff in Mage.
Wraith is awesome. Mage is, all of them are good.
Yeah.
Like every single old world of darkness setting is super fun. Changeling is the coolest the Fae has ever been.
Oh yeah.
you know, to me, like it's a triumph of flavor. Mm-hmm. It is a really, really good setting.
Yeah.
In a world without Shadowrun, it would be my favorite set of, like, you know, setting stuff.
Yeah.
So just getting that out there, because I want to let people know when things change, mm-hmm, you know, in advance. If you're only here for D&D, if you have no interest in Vampire, I kind of understand, mm-hmm, you should give Bloodlines a shot.
Yeah.
And like our last season, part of the goal here is for this to function as a let's play as well.
Yes.
If you are not going to play Bloodlines, which I understand, it's an old janky game, mm-hmm, let us do it for you.
Yeah. Should we say like this episode's going out for everybody? We're going to make this a free one to try and draw people in. Yeah.
So, sure. Yeah. Let people know what to expect.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And if you listen to season one and you have come to trust our taste on a bunch of this, and follow us along, please.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it'll be good. I wrote this when I was still prior to doing the notes,
mm-hmm,
any of the notes. Now that I'm in the groove, and I'm starting kind of the rhythm and everything, I'm feeling more confident.
Yeah.
Like about how this season will shake out.
Yeah. Even just talking about clans and doing those primers, we're going to be dining on that.
It's so dineable. Mm-hmm. It's like one of the most dineable settings in the world.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the game.
Yeah.
Let's get into Bloodlines here.
Yeah. This was put out in 2004, which is a weird era for PC games, to say the least.
Yes.
And it was developed by Troika Games and published by Activision. Troika is a whole thing. This is more of a Gary thing than a Kay thing. I had to look up to remind myself what they made. Arcanum of Steamworks and Magic Obscura, which is a sword of Damocles hanging over my head.
If
you trust Gary.
Fucking cut you. Bleh!
Bleh!
Fucking doomed. Because that is a mechanically frustrating game that you will love everything else about.
Yeah.
And is too interesting to never talk about.
Yes. They also did the Temple of Elemental Evil adaptation, the PC one, yes, back in the day.
They are former Black Isle developers, so Fallout 2 people, mm-hmm, and stuff, who, and also some of the people went on to be in exile.
Yeah.
So kind of keeping that lineage alive.
Mm-hmm.
They only did these three games.
Yeah.
Through them. And all three of them are cult classics for different reasons,
mm-hmm,
which is really interesting. Not everybody knows this, but Bloodlines itself is actually a sequel.
Yeah.
There's another Vampire the Masquerade game called Vampire the Masquerade Redemption. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that at some point this season. I've been looking for an excuse to play that.
Same.
I'm real curious about it. Mm-hmm. So we'll probably talk about that at some point.
Yeah.
So this is an indirect sequel, and this has one of the most troubled developments. You know, it's a troubled development legend.
It's a troubled development legend, followed almost immediately by Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2, which is also one of the most troubled things. And I am so worried.
I've never been more worried in my life. Like, there's not character creation.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Like, they keep releasing details that are designed to stab me in the stomach.
Uh-huh.
This game floundered for 3 years without even having a producer.
Yeah.
And Activision, the publisher, ended up assigning one, a guy named David Mulock, and set a firm deadline. And when Mulock came on board, he found that it was a mess.
Yeah.
There were levels that are completely incomplete and abandoned.
Yeah.
It was half finished.
Mm-hmm. So working with that, they were also releasing this kind of in this corridor with Half-Life 2, Metal Gear Solid 3, and Halo 2.
Yes. Stiff competition.
Yeah.
This game sold fewer than 80,000 copies.
Mm-hmm.
That's very low.
Yeah.
Similar to all Troika games, the critics were really mixed on this. The people, I feel like the kind of long view critics, mm-hmm. Or good critics, enjoyed it. And the more technically minded, the glitch baby critics or weakling critics
mm-hmm.
just complained about technical issues.
The critics who are not going to make it is what we call them. Anybody who was looking at it like as a product first. Would have come down on like, hey, this isn't worth your money just because of the technical stuff. The fact that it comes apart in the last third of it.
Yeah. Fools. Like we don't, in the future, that's how you get, absolutely jumped by a cult classic
mm-hmm.
complaining about stuff like that. That stuff's very important. I'm not trying to, if anyone's had a frustrating glitch experience with this, I'm not trying to minimize that.
Yeah.
It's just that stuff will get smoothed over with time. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
No. It did.
Yeah. Yeah. And fans picked this up. This is one that is completely, floated and maintained and made playable today by the community.
So much so that to this day, I think the most recent unofficial patch update was December
mm-hmm.
2024.
Yeah.
Last time I checked. So like this is fans are taking care of this game.
Mm-hmm.
It is a beautiful example of the way that games can do that. So the fans are taking care of it, and for the devs, even though they did leave levels half finished, like there was an oversight, like a management issue. This was a labor of love. Jason Anderson, the main Troika guy, spent a lot of time researching the tabletop game. He wanted to understand its core appeal, and the lead writer of this, Brian Matsoda, worked to set it kind of apart from other RPGs, put in a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And what they understood was the appeal of the tabletop game is not in combat or traditional power fantasies, but in vampire politics.
Yes.
Here. Mitsuda kind of took this and ran with it and wanted characters to have these distinct personalities and motivations and not be quest givers.
Mm-hmm.
Characters are not exclamation points that spit out. It's not Veilguard.
Yeah.
spit out XP when you do the task
mm-hmm.
for them.
Yeah. They're not just like signposts. Like these are pretty messed up. You're dealing with vampires who all want things of you and are dubiously ethical.
Yes. It's kind of a messy bitch simulator, but in a less online way.
Yeah.
Actually more messy.
Mm-hmm.
Real mess, not like, I don't know. When people call themselves a messy bitch online, I think that they're probably referring to having like breakfast an hour later or some shit. Like there's nothing messy about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm a disaster. Oh, are you? Like, are you a disaster?
No. Yeah. You wait till you run out of underwear to do your laundry.
Oh, you only had two pairs of underwear left. What a disaster. Call the tabloids.
Oh.
They did such a good job integrating the setting that this game is canon.
Mm-hmm.
White Wolf, one of the things that sets it apart, we'll talk about the tabletop game in a bit, is that it has a long, large, singular meta story.
Mm-hmm.
And this got incorporated into it.
Yeah.
Which is kind of neat. Like all this stuff is canon. This is all true.
Mm-hmm. It happened to me.
Literally based on real events. You, you, the review for Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines is, this happened to my friend Jeff.
Yeah. And there's some big stuff that goes on in this as regards the Camarilla and some, let's say, very important figures in vampire history.
Yeah, you meet some real luminaries. Mm-hmm. Things do fall down in the play department.
Yeah.
Which we'll talk about. Kind of the origin of that, Troika had previously only made turn-based games in 2D, so they needed to make a 3D real-time combat system. Mm-hmm. It does have dice rolls and statistic-based outcomes. This is, 2 years after Morrowind came out, but it was new to them. Mm-hmm. And it was difficult. This is a multiplayer, tabletop RPG.
Yeah.
They need to make this single player. Here. And the way they approached this was they harvested as many mechanics that made sense, but only ended up using about half the skills and only some of the mechanics.
Right. Yes. Yeah. If you have most of your skills designed to solve, interpersonal conflicts, like that, it can only play out so many different ways in an RPG that by all rights plays kind of like it wants to be a shooter. I think primarily because they're playing it in, they made it in Source, right? This is one of those early games that use the Source engine, but like had its development upended by the fact that Half-Life 2 came out when and how it did.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And having not only skills applied to social situations, but also open-ended problems.
Yes.
Which is the issue of adaptation for tabletop to video game generally, mm-hmm. right? And we see that all the time on WoW. Like that even shows up in like Tide of Numenera.
Yeah.
As a thing. Like they did a better job than a lot of systems of doing that, but that is a persistent challenge. Mm-hmm. I hear. And those growing pains show.
Yeah.
I hear. They want to make choice this prime value, but the scope kind of outgrew the resources and timelines. Mm-hmm. Which basically means this game is famous for having the first two-thirds of it or so being a thing where you can approach most problems in several different ways equally, and then at the end game you can't.
Right.
It kind of runs out. It's actually really similar to kind of an inverse version of Lionheart, which is the last Infinity Engine game. I think it's the last Black Isle game as well, if I recall, which just the first act is apparently incredible and does all the promises, mm-hmm. That entails. And then it becomes a dungeon crawl where your only verb is fight. That does that, one third or one fourth the way through. This maintains for longer than I think its reputation.
Yeah.
Says, the first 2 to 3 zones are really strong.
Yes.
In this.
Yeah. When we say like, oh, they didn't do a very good job of honoring all the choices, if you play the first 2/3 of this building around being kind of a social operator, right? Or, trying to be stealthy, all these, options, Deus Ex-like options that are available to you, and you do not put anything into combat, you are going to fail. You're going to hit a wall. I think that is an awful lot of that accounts for an awful lot of people's kind of sour taste when they kind of hit this and then end up having a bad time.
Yeah, it sucks. It's an undeniable flaw in the game. Mm-hmm. It would be stronger if it maintained that promise throughout. It's rare that games do.
Yep.
But it would be cool if it did. When you know what you're getting into, it is not that burdensome to put some points into combat as well. Mm-hmm. You get enough stuff. You don't fuck yourself over mm-hmm. easily. It's good to know that though going in.
Yeah.
I think. When this is firing on all cylinders, even the gameplay and combat in Bloodlines is not super fun.
Right.
This is not a tactical masterpiece like Baldur's Gate 3. This is, even firing at absolutely all cylinders mechanically, I think serviceable.
Yeah.
All of the funness, all the greatness in this, and there's true greatness, is in dialogue, exploration, imsim stuff, reactivity.
Yes.
Characters reacting in realistic ways to things in their world. The thing that, again, if you're a TV Tropes head, developer foresight. Mm-hmm. Good games have a developer foresight page. Bad games don't. this has incredible developer foresight.
Yeah. Yeah. So all of that happened in spite of the fact that this was forced out the door early.
Yes. Activision kind of boned it.
Yeah.
You know, it was released unfinished. They had to put in a bunch of crunch and overtime, including some of the staff working unpaid, just to get the game out.
Yeah.
And like the tragedy of all video games, the amount of, not all video games, but a lot of video games, that work was not rewarded.
Right.
Because they were put under this economic pressure, largely because of that, it was a commercial failure, and most of the devs got laid off. The rest of the staff kind of tried to stay and patch it into shape, which they did, helped on that, and they tried to secure funding to keep the studio going, but this was for naught, and Troika died.
Yeah. And people moved on to their own concerns.
Yeah. And eventually went on to other games and stuff where they were more successful, you know, in terms of not getting boned by publishers.
It was just a matter of waiting until like the first Kickstarter wave, I think.
Basically. Yeah. Like the democratization of, you know, like if you are reliant on Activision, you know, how much freedom do you have?
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting, you know, it's interesting where gaming's at right now. How this is becoming a real problem, but it's interesting to see the ways that this has been in the cards forever.
Yes.
You know, this game has been, you know, despite all those problems, has been vindicated by history, you know, both by fans and critics.
Yeah.
There's a quote here that I like from Rock, Paper, Shotgun. The sense of sorrow that comes from the realization that there's nothing like Bloodlines on the horizon. Why should there be so few games like this? Oh, right, because it's so very hard to do. The lack of games comparable to Bloodlines is one of the great tragedies of our time.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of great tragedies in this specific time.
We're living in a time that's a crowded that is field. Defined by tragedies, yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's a crowded field. When I think of the great tragedies, I don't necessarily think that there's not a good Bloodlines out there comparable with, like, you know, human rights stuff. But in terms of culturally or video game-wise, it does suck.
Yeah.
That there is not more stuff like this.
You know, and that like there are games with narrative and intricacy. There are games that have, you know, some very good mechanical aptitude and open-endedness and stuff. Something that combines those as cannily as this does.
Yeah.
You know, like they are rare treasures.
Yeah. Still a rare bird. If you don't know anything about what this game is, here's what, how it is. Here's how you play. It is a first and third person action RPG. It is a hub-based world. So you kind of go from hub to hub. You have a very complicated dialogue system and very reactive quests.
Yes.
You're let loose in the hub. You usually have a lead on someone to direct you, but you can just explore that hub, do things out of order and kind of follow your nose and find stuff to do.
Yeah. And these hubs are in and around the city of LA.
Yes.
You know, so like there will be, you know, dungeons that are just buildings, right? Like one of your first, you know, one of the early ones is like the Blood Bank, in, you know, in Santa Monica, you know, downtown there. Yeah.
And you go to some landmarks as well. You go to like Griffith Park.
Yes.
Later and stuff, the observatory. Character creation is very important in this in a way that is rarely seen in games.
Yeah.
Characters will react differently to you depending on what clans you're in. And a couple clans play completely differently.
Yeah.
Like fully half of them, basically, if we count Tremere being the magic clan, play very differently. You have a lot of options in terms of build. So generally, as we mentioned before, maps onto MSIM paths of combat, talking, sneaking, and hacking. And within combat, there are a couple of different approaches. You can do unarmed, melee, magic, and guns. You need to put points into one of them.
Otherwise you're going to have a very bad time. And they play differently. Like the quality between them is pretty rough too.
Yes.
Like I do not like the way the melee feels in this at all.
No, it's horrible.
Yeah.
The you know, and we'll talk about those in depth during segments, you know, of why it's, you know, we're going to be harder on this than Baldur's Gate 3.
Well, yeah, because it's objectively worse.
It's an objectively worse game while still being very special.
Right.
As a thing. And they're also not equally qualitative in terms of efficacy. The game is not so hard that you can't make it work with like a melee, you know, an armed fighter.
Yeah.
But it's harder.
Yes.
You know, each vampire clan has access to certain powers. These are called disciplines. These are like spells. They have ranks. And these can be used in combat. They can help you notice your environment better. They can boost your stats. They can influence conversations. There are a wide variety of these.
Yes.
One of the most fun things you can do as a vampire is get vampire powers.
When I was in high school, this taught me what an auspex was.
Yeah. Yeah. You love learning words. Obfuscate.
Yeah.
A bunch of skill checks. There are a lot of skill checks in this, and they are threshold based.
Mm-hmm.
So not chance based, but your attacks are governed by die rolls.
Right.
So you have to crest a minimum number to pick a lock, but your aiming reticule will shrink faster with additional skill. Mm-hmm. Or you'll attack. It will look like you connected, mm-hmm. But you'll have a big zero pop up for no damage, Morrowind style.
Yes. This is in the Morrowind and Mass Effect camp of this plays like an action game, but what you see is not what you get.
Yep. Yeah. So you do quest and you explore and you drink blood. And you gain experience. Eventually, you do a storyline quest that will take you to the next hub or to a standalone dungeon between hubs.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go back to hubs there. You can't go back to standalone dungeons usually, but you can go back to hubs and you'll have quests that kind of go between different areas.
Yes.
There. Yeah. None of these systems are complicated on their own, which is kind of an MSim thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like the shooting in Deus Ex is not super complicated.
Yeah.
Stealth in Deus Ex is not very complicated. Same thing here.
Mm-hmm.
Combat is you stand next to a guy and hit him or shoot him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hacking and lockpicking are not mini games. They're just a progress bar that is influenced by your stat.
Yes.
Through this.
Yeah.
It is the kind of amalgamation of everything that makes it fun.
It's the way that they interact with each other to affect your progress, right?
Yes.
And of course, blood, Gary. Blood.
Blood. Bleh. blood is your mana meter, basically. Mm-hmm. It powers your disciplines. It helps you heal. You have to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of a life sim aspect of this. Like your blood will drain. Sometimes you need a fix. Mm-hmm. You will have to go out and go into the herd and drink blood. You can also do it in combat.
Yep.
Depending on your melee skills, which can be really useful because you heal a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You drink blood. It is part of the rhythm of play.
Yes.
Maintaining your blood.
Entering into the blood rain is sexy, writhing, legs wrapped around the person, feeding it animation. It feels
apparently so good to get your blood sucked.
I guess, yeah.
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 One of the reasons I intuit that is because the Giovanni, the mobster necromancer clan, their clan curse is that it is excruciatingly painful.
Oh.
For them when they suck blood, so that it's really hard for them to be subtle about it.
Yeah.
You know?
They can't just go clubbing like everybody else does. Yeah.
Everyone else, you go clubbing or you ask somebody to like take you to an alley,
mm-hmm.
you know? And because of the nature of the game, you just find somebody who's wandering around in a corner.
Yeah.
Far enough away from somebody and, and do it. But it's a fun thing to maintain and it's its own little mini game.
Mm-hmm. And that is relates to another mechanic here that is brought over from the campaign or from the tabletop system. You do have a limited number of masquerade violations. These are strikes where you reveal to the herd, where you reveal to humanity that you are a vampire or that vampires exist. And you have five of these before you are destroyed by the Camarilla, by the kind of governing body.
It's a resource along with humanity. There's we got a close up on those. We'll talk about kind of early on, like the first few episodes, we're going to go deep on a couple of these mm-hmm. mechanics. I had kind of forgotten that masquerade violations are, a renewing resource.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have five of them, but you also have actions that will get them back.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a thing for you to spend, as a thing to do shitty things.
Yeah.
If you want, or you just really need to get the fuck out of Dodge and you turn on max celerity and super speed. Out of there.
Yeah.
That's the basics of how it plays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine a slow paced third person / first person. You can switch,
mm-hmm.
Action game.
Yes.
Yeah. The tabletop game we're going to be unspooling throughout the season. We don't want to talk too much about it, but here are kind of the basics. If you don't know Vampire the Masquerade at all.
Right.
The Old World of Darkness specifically is interconnected as a series of tabletop role-playing games and books. Fiction created by Mark Rain Hagen for White Wolf Publishing in 1991.
And this is so 90s.
Oh, it's beautifully 90s.
It's the most
deliciously 90s.
It's the most 90s. Even the fifth edition, which mm-hmm. I think is the most recent, even though it's several years old at this point. Even that feels very 90s, like down to like you get the general like decayed aesthetic, you know, the grungy visuals. I love it so much.
I love old Vampire the Masquerade art of like LARPers and sunglasses smoking
mm-hmm.
is what half the illustrations look like.
It's beautiful.
It's really good. Like we're in a scunge zone that is made Like I enjoy it quite a bit.
Yeah. So yeah, you play, you know, in any of these old World of Darkness games, they're arranged around different supernatural creatures, and they're in a shared setting. I understand this is not the case for New World of Darkness, that those are a little bit more separated from each other.
Yes. That is my understanding as well. I'm not as familiar with New World of Darkness as Old World of Darkness, in terms of diving and stuff.
Yeah.
I think they did kind of break that out.
Yeah.
Initially, part of the appeal was, you know, you'd be playing as a vampire or a werewolf or a ghost. You're all in the same world. The same thing is happening to everybody. Mm-hmm. And theoretically, if you had all the books and everything, you could have a party that was a vampire, werewolf, and a ghost.
Yes.
You could have a whole monster squad. Mm-hmm. They have different mechanics. They have different concerns. That would be hard to run.
Mm-hmm.
But it was modular in that way.
Yeah.
And one of the big selling points was this concept of personal horror. When they describe the game, they say it is a game of personal horror.
Mm-hmm.
Old World of Darkness was not the first tabletop role-playing game to focus on kind of relationships and politics, you know, forces bigger than the player. But it was a really early hit in that realm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the, it's not quite Call of Cthulhu like disempowerment because you actually are pretty tough.
Mm-hmm.
The focus, though, is not on that empowerment at all.
No, not at all. And something that's important about this, we said that, you know, Bloodlines takes place in LA. The World of Darkness is on Earth, right?
Yes.
There's alternate history and stuff because you have all the supernatural stuff in play, but not as much as you would expect because of the masquerade kind of stuff that goes on. Like, this is still a hidden kind of underworld that kind of underlies our own.
It's real similar to, if you know tabletop games of the time, similar to Unknown Armies, which is a similar kind of game about, you know, the world underneath our world as a thing.
Yeah.
This game was supported with just an absolutely immense amount of lore and back matter.
Yeah.
Splat books. There were so many books for this, I hear. And a really oppressive atmosphere was part of this. It's our world, but something is wrong.
Yeah.
It's darker. There is a secret reality behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And kind of to take that further, each individual series explored a specific tragic theme.
Mm-hmm.
So with vampires, we're largely concerned with redemption and what it means to hold on to your humanity.
Yes.
You know, once you've taken the dark gift. Werewolf, for example, is our like place as stewards of the earth. That is much more of an environmental kind of concern, which is also very 90s, you know, as a thing. Just different traumas.
Yeah.
You know, are the focus of these different things.
Which are all very cannily chosen and kind of paired with, you know, these folklore monsters, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
They really want you to embrace the shittiness of this. One of the hallmarks of this tabletop game is upsides and downsides. Each clan, you know, a vampire, each group of werewolf, every type of Frankenstein has powerful upsides, but very powerful downsides. Kind of an early example of using these as opportunities for role play. You know, everything is a trade-off. They really want you to accept suboptimal results in this game.
Yeah.
This is editorializing. I think this is a bad game mechanically. Old World of Darkness. It came out at the wrong time for this. I think that this wanted to be a game that was less crunchy and more story-based, but the medium didn't really have mechanics to support that just yet. There's a lot of null result, trying something and having it fail, which is a tabletop bugbear.
Yeah.
You know, like, in looking at how tabletop games have developed, you could probably make the argument that the quest of tabletop design has been trying to deal with the null result. You know,
explain what a null result is for somebody who is coming to this from, you know, video game side, where that is not necessarily, I think the closest thing you get is just misses, right?
Yeah, it's not a bad thing in video games because you get so many times at the bat.
Yeah.
You know, it's like wasting a turn. Like it's your turn. You have to, or not even a turn. You go into a room, you're doing a spot hidden check to find a clue. That is an all or nothing thing.
Yeah.
You succeed or fail at that. If you fail at that, then what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that feels bad. You don't have a recourse for it. You can't just look again because that kind of interrupts the story. You know, that feels artificial. Or when you attack, just missing and nothing happening.
Right. Yeah.
In video game, no big deal.
Mm-hmm. Just going to swing again. Yeah.
Yeah. At the table feels bad. You have to wait for your turn again and you want to do cool stuff.
Yeah.
That's a cool illustration of that. If you look at like Call of Cthulhu to Trail of Cthulhu, which is a kind of update on that to emphasize investigation. They got rid of that for investigation.
Yeah.
You get the clues, you know, the way you get them can change, but there's no arguing it. You get the clues. That is how they got around that.
Yeah. Part of the problem with this, I think this is a too small numbers RPG actually in table play, tabletop play. You know, like you're dealing with, you know, your individual skills, you have like one to five ranks, right?
Yeah.
It's just in this weird, kind of in between space. And when I think about, you know, World of Darkness, specifically Vampire, in my head, and I do not know if this is like just more related to my personal experience or like what the scene was like in college, for me at the University of Cincinnati, but I associate like the World of Darkness setting stuff with like more serious IRL role play stuff that almost like borders on LARP. Right.
Where, yeah. There's a whole Mind's Eye Theater.
Yeah.
Vampire kind of subgroup and stuff. And because it's about vampires, like, I don't know, that attracts a certain kind of theater dork.
Yeah. Theater dork, goth fashion person. Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, who isn't here to play a game, is here to pretend to be a vampire out in the woods with people they might want to make out with.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, they do not care that rolling all D10s in a dice pool makes your result really swingy.
Yeah.
You know, and having no recourse or anything. This even comes down to the rules. A lot of the rules are very vague.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were putting a lot of trust into the storyteller.
Yeah.
Which is the dungeon master of this.
You mean like Dave Grohl?
you have to actually put on a Dave Grohl costume.
Okay.
All right. Put up your Dave Grohl DM screen.
And just you put on the Kirsten Cinema glasses. Yeah.
Yep. And that's how you can tell. Yeah. But yeah, you take on the role of the storyteller. Mm-hmm. And the books were just like, this does this impossible thing. If you want to see an example of that, reading The Mage.
Mm-hmm.
Source books is really fun because their whole thing is like breaking reality. So it'll give you like a two sentence description of how this would break reality with no mechanics to back it up, you know, as a thing. And it's kind of like, you figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, and if the whole crew, if everybody at the table is on board with that, I think that's cool. You know, everyone can do that. Everyone can go with the flow here. But if you're trying to get the numbers or if you want more guidance, it's a lot more difficult.
Yeah.
And that is something that as tabletop RPGs have evolved, games have leaned into and gotten better at navigating.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially like Power by the Apocalypse kind of stuff.
That was a huge.
Yeah.
You know, a huge in finding the balance, I think, between mechanical and flavor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the best rules light.
Yeah.
Game that exists like somebody frame, don't like rules like
framework games. Stuff
it stomps the shit out of like something like Fate.
Mm-hmm.
So this game to me is an early example of way better to read than to play, along with Shadowrun, which I love but is not fun to play. There are just a lot of systems and splat books, a lot of things to know, a lot of detail. All of it is really fun to know.
Yeah.
But at the table, it kind of flops.
Yeah. Or at the very least is so dependent on the quality of the DM and the group that there's a higher than normal chance that that it's just going to kind of like not work out with your dynamic. Right.
Yeah. And that's that's my experience.
Yeah.
With it. You could have had a great time. Like there are people listening to this who I think I'm sure have had like long running vampire games that have gone great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your group is just, I think, maybe more suited to it than mine has been.
Yeah.
You know, and that I'm not trying to invalidate that or anything like that. Just in my two cents.
Yeah. It just, it stands to reason because clarity of rules, I think, is a very important backstop. Right.
Yes.
Like, you know, clarity of rules doesn't just resolve conflicts. It makes it very, you know, very apparent what options are available to you, I think.
Yeah, it defines the play space and it's the text of what the game is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the fluff, you know, which we both love.
Yeah.
Fluff and tabletop stuff is somewhere between a game and fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like reading a source book for fun, reading the Ventru clan handbook
of
this is not quite reading fiction, but it's closer to fiction than a game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the actual rules, the text of how the mechanics work, that is the part that is the game.
Yeah.
That kind of, you know, it's the skeleton
mm-hmm.
for this. Yeah. If anything, I can convince anybody to do anything in this. If I can't convince you to play Bloodlines, hopefully I can convince you to check out these source books.
Yeah.
They're fun.
They pop up on Humble Bundle, I think twice a year is roughly the clip where that is. And you're able to get like pretty much everything that has been released for the most, you know, the most recent version, you know, and those are really big source books as well.
Yeah, there are tons of content. And it's also, it's not hard if you want to pirate the old ones.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you prefer the old editions, it's not hard.
No.
They're around. You can find PDFs of them. You don't even have to, like, pirate is too strong a word.
Right.
Like Google, you know, vampire, you know, clan book PDF.
Mm-hmm.
And it just pops up. It doesn't even feel like you're doing anything.
Yeah.
You know, because nobody wants the old ones.
Nope.
There. For a while, they were everywhere in thrift stores.
Oh, God, sick. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like every, when a new edition came out, this was like Goodwill to, you know, hit the Goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
Cause you'll get a bunch of cool shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's almost everything. We're going to get into the tutorial and everything and kind of get introduced to the world in the next episode.
Mm-hmm.
Before that though, let's talk about, what kind of build you're playing. Cause several people have asked, that.
Yes. So I have not started playing yet. That is for me. Because Gary got to do the Dark Urge, last time, Gary got the special playthrough. Mm-hmm. I am going to be playing the Tremere. I'm going to mm-hmm. be playing the mage ones because I've never done that before.
Yeah. There are three different clans. That's almost half the clans mm-hmm. that play very differently in this game. The Tremere is one of them. They have a unique ending. They have a unique quest giver. They have one of their disciplines is a kind of a Swiss Army knife of magic
mm-hmm.
that they have. They are the caster class.
Yes.
In this and play a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing something more straight up the middle because I want to do something representative. I was going to play as a Ventru because I never had, but I couldn't stomach it. There's a part in this, there's one of the dungeons later is a sewer.
Mm-hmm.
And Ventrus can't eat rats.
Nope.
and the sewer is just rats. And I was like, well, I could be a Ventru and just cheat my way through that.
Uh-huh.
And like, I have nothing to prove in this game. Like I beat this several times.
Yeah.
But I couldn't do that. So I'm playing a Bruja.
Okay.
A Bruja. I think it's Bruja. That's how you pronounce that. I have never played one of them before.
Mm-hmm.
They are the punks.
Yes.
They are, you know, semi-animalistic, not as animalistic as the Gangrel,
mm-hmm.
But kind of anarchist.
Yeah, they're anarchist, but not always officially anarchs. Anarch is a very specific thing in this setting.
Yeah, all of that stuff we'll explain. They descend from a race of kind of warrior philosophers,
mm-hmm.
The idea, but now they're kind of anti-authoritarians.
Yeah.
There.
The... what I consider to be like the bog standard play, like clans to take on this are either the Bruja or the Toreador.
Yeah.
You know, Bruja having an emphasis on combat kind of stuff and Toreador being more on the social skill side.
Toreadors are also weirdly great at combat because they have celerity.
Yeah.
They have the speed one. Every time I'd play this, you know, just as for fun, like my natural inclination is Toreador.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I'm a special little lad
mm-hmm.
and I like the artist. ones. The other two wacky ones that people have asked about are Malkavians and Nosferatu. Nosferatu in this world, and we'll do a whole detailed close-up, but just for context, in case anyone's playing along with this, I wouldn't recommend playing one of those two mm-hmm. as your first playthrough. They are Orlocks.
Yeah.
You know, you are the Nosferatu from the movie Nosferatu, mm-hmm. so you can't be out in public.
Yes.
To get around this, you can turn invisible and you can cruise around the sewers. But you have to play very differently
mm-hmm.
Because of that. And then Malkavians, one of the coolest things that I feel like game developers done,
mm-hmm.
Their whole thing is that they have, they're mad. They have madness. So they have insane insights.
Mm-hmm.
Your dialogue, this would be an opportunity to make your dialogue entirely monkey cheese lore random.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a little bit of that, but instead they mostly have you obliquely foreshadow the plot.
Yep.
And kind of know the future of things. And as much as a Malkavian playthrough is super fun, I've done one.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do it for the show because it's just constantly hinting at the plot.
And it's like, okay, and next we're going to talk to the stop sign.
And we're going to talk about that stuff. Like, we got the one of the segments I have is the Malkavian minute.
Uh-huh.
When that stuff pops up, because those scenarios are really good. Like when the news starts talking to you and stuff, it's really cool. They put that stuff in there.
Yeah.
It's just, it makes the rest of your dialogue not very representative.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're all viable. Mm-hmm. Like if you decide to play, and if you're playing this on PC, cheat if you have to.
Yeah.
Get to that dungeon and put on noclip and just get through it.
Yeah.
It sucks. It's a shitty dungeon. It's one of my least favorite dungeons in the history of video games.
They kind of barely bothered to make it, so you are only I think obliged to play it.
Yes, that's exactly that. Like, don't put in more effort than they did. for that bit. That's it. Mm-hmm. So next episode, we're getting embraced. We're doing the opening cutscene, kind of being introduced to our vampire politics and doing our tutorial and getting into some more basics of play.
Mm-hmm. Bender's going to show us the ropes.
Bender's showing us the ropes. Mm-hmm. One of the things early on was I said that it would probably be about 2 episodes per hub. It's going to be more than that.
Yeah.
There's more to talk about than I thought.
Yes.
So that's great. Mm-hmm. I want to camp out here for a little bit. So it will certainly not be a 66 episode.
No,
Baldur's Gate 3 length season, but it also will not be a 10-episode season.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
What can people do?
Well, if you're hearing this on the free feed and you have not done so, go to patreon.com/duckfeedtv, where you can subscribe and get all of the episodes coming out, but also all of the stuff that came before. If you just did a search for Bloodlines podcast, hi. We also talked about Baldur's Gate 3 in great detail.
Yeah. And kind of, I hope this, you know, the way this, depending on how the season goes, you know, everything, this will kind of form again. You need 2 points to make a line.
Mm-hmm.
It would be cool to, I'm optimistic about how well this will go and what it speaks of for the future of the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea of jumping with this kind of frequency
mm-hmm.
to new systems and games is really exciting to me.
Oh yeah. Just any kind of excuse to go on a deep dive into these.
Yeah.
You know, probably, you know, maybe not exclusively tabletop stuff, but like, there are a lot of options for things that have very well-established settings.
Yeah, and there's a lot of tabletop stuff I'd like to do.
Yeah.
You know, and like just rubbing my hands at that Shadowrun trilogy season. Just like, fuck.
Fuck. Yeah. Oh, man, to go back to, man, getting through all of Dragonfall in 2 episodes. Gary, what were we thinking?
What were we thinking? Like, you got to slow it down.
Yeah.
It's because I'm old now, but I'm like, everything should be slow.
Yeah.
Slow is such a good speed, you know, like be it walking, driving or covering a video game.
Yeah. And when we say like, oh, covering in 2 episodes, if you have not listened to our flagship show, Watch Out for Fireballs, a lot of the stuff we have talked about, maybe don't go back and listen to the first Masquerade Bloodlines episode, you know, I think we opened that with a pretty ableist joke for which I'm very sorry.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. One of the things I had planned, depending on how much space we need to fill,
mm-hmm.
is giving that a re-listen and having that be a segment. Like, you know, what was that like?
Yeah.
The coverage. But yeah, you know, it was a long time ago, 14 years ago.
Yeah.
We got better. And we're hoping to make up for it here.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah. Big thanks are the art for the show. You saw seen that already. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's so good.
Super good. Randy Walker did a fucking knockout job.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent work. I've heard the at the time of recording, the close to final version of the theme song
good.
It's also really good.
It's what a treasure we have in Gwen. Even just in terms of like the music composition, just like somebody that we can reliably say, oh, hey, here's this brand new style of music to you. And she can put out something like that.
That's the thing that is really cool about having Gwen do music stuff for us. Like I like the way that Gary makes music, but I am not a chameleon. Like I can't. I couldn't have done that.
Yeah.
You know, I can't like do a thing in a style.
Yeah.
That same way. And she's really good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good theme. Mm-hmm. You know, it matches the tone real well. So join us in getting break out your Lacuna Coil records and join us here. And until next time, our famous sign off. Thanks for nothing.